in the, then the president took office, and did you have any doubt that he was going to omit the amendment again from his address to Congress?
Well, I think that'll be 1916.
Yeah, because he did.
Well, we took it for granted he'd never change his position that we knew of.
That was when Mabel unfurled her banner from the gallery in the middle of his address.
No, she unfurled that banner, as I remember, on a speech that he was making for the, I think it was the Puerto Ricans or some group.
Oh, you're right in that. It was his message to Congress on what he wanted to do with the legislation that year in January of 1917, and he had gone on eloquently about the suffrage that had been granted and the freedom given to the Filipinos, meaning Filipino men.
Seemed to me was this Filipinos? I thought it was Puerto Ricans or somebody.
Filipinos.
Was it Filipinos?
Yeah. And that was the moment that Mabel chose to unfurl her large banner from the balcony, which she's told me about in her interview.
Yes, but there were others, you know, it wasn't just Mabel.
And yes, there were five.
And the way we got it done was through Mrs. Elizabeth Rogers, when I've told you so much about.
Oh, yeah?
And Mrs. Rogers' husband was, you know, the greatest authority probably in the United States on goiters. I guess you know that.
Oh.
And people went from all over the country to him. We have her photo, her painting down on the walls in the headquarters.
And how did she help with this?
Well, pardon me. When she was a young and very beautiful girl, apparently, the daughter, I think, of a judge, anyway, an eminent, distinguished lawyer up in New Haven, and Dr. Rogers was a medical student there, they became engaged to be married. And suddenly she developed a goiter. And so he said that he was going to devote all his time because she would no longer marry him. She said, goiter is incurable, and I'm not going to be your wife and have this disfigurement. And also had other effects, I guess, on your body. So she said she wouldn't marry him. And he said, well, then I'm going to drop everything else. I'm going to find out how to cure goiters. So he concentrated as a young medical student, and he did discover a cure for goiters. And it was the first time it ever happened. And so he cured Mrs. Rogers, and she became his bride after that and married him. And he therefore, having, for his own interest in curing Mrs. Rogers, become an authority in this field of not only goiters, but everything connected with the thyroid and so on. And so people came from all over the country, and I always nearly stayed with Mrs. Rogers when I went up to New York. Instead of going to a hotel, she always invited me to come, and to save expense, I always went. And also because I wanted to get always as be with her as much as possible. And I remember when I would go in the front door, it was one of those houses in New York where you have on the ground floor your dining room, then a steep stairway, and then upstairs, sort of living quarters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd walk up the stairs, and it was almost impossible to walk up because every single step was covered by women seated there or men seated there, waiting to see Dr. Rogers because of their thyroid or gland or something.
My goodness.
And finally, it got to be so that he would never make an appointment. He took anybody who came, and he charged them all the same, I think $2 a visit. And it was almost a miracle, the way they were cured. So finally, I remember so vividly when I would go up, Mrs. Rogers, I would find, had been driven up to the top floor of this big house. Mm-hmm. The only place she could sit receive were friends or anywhere, because the whole second floor where he had his office was just filled with some more of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would never send a bill, but he had a secretary, Mrs. Rogers, and the secretary together would contrive to send out the $2 bills to people. But he was just a marvelous man in being unselfish and completely unselfish type, I thought. So one day I was there, happened to be there when this occurred. He came in and he told us at the dining room table, all of us, that one of his Yale classmates had brought his wife to see him that day, and this Yale classmate had a wife who had the shingles. You know what shingles are?
It's a rash, isn't it?
Something you go all around your waist, I think.
Mm.
And he was a member of Congress, and he was a very wealthy man. So he'd taken his wife to Austria and to all places in the world where they were supposed to be great experts and health measures to try to have the shingles cured. It seems it goes all the way around, and I don't know what consequences it has, but he never could get any relief for his wife. And he said, Dr. Rogers said, now people have been saying to him, well, why in the world don't you take your wife to Dr. Rogers? Why do you go all over the world? And he said, Dr. Rogers, I never would go to him. He said, I was on the crew with him in Yale. He doesn't know one single thing about it. And this man, all he could do was to be a good person in our Yale races and so on. So he said, finally, when it grew so desperate and his wife was always getting worse, he was definitely very devoted to her, that he said, all right, he would swallow his prejudice against this fellow crewmate and go and see him. So she told me, this day he's come with his wife. And he said, I saw in a minute what was the matter with her. It was very simple. I knew exactly what to do. And I gave her some pills to take and said, the whole thing disappeared. She's completely cured. There was no reason at all for all this years of hesitation. It's very simple to anybody who's familiar now with all these glands.
Mm-hmm.
So then this man talked to Mrs. Rogers and said, you know, Dr. Rogers won't allow me to pay him anything, and I can because the only thing I have is quite a good deal of money, and I'd like to pay him. He won't allow me to give him a single 10-cent piece, and I feel so indebted. This has transformed our lives, what he's done for us. And he said, if you ever need anything in Congress, come to me. No matter what it is, I will get it done for you. Because it'd be a little way I might repay Dr. Rogers. So when we decided we would have a banner put out, when we knew this, you say Filipinos, whatever was going to come up, to point out that he was so solicitous for equality for other people, not for people at home, just the same way we did when we were burning his words, you know.
Yeah.
Later on.
Yeah.
So, Mrs. Rogers said, now I think, I've never asked Mr. So-and-so for anything, this congressman, and he said it was an impossible time to get a ticket. It always was these times the president spoke. There were only a few tickets, and they were given out to the wives and so on.
Oh, yes.
And the diplomats. You couldn't. I've never gotten a ticket, but I've never asked for one because I didn't like to be under obligation to anybody. I've never gotten a ticket to anything since I first went up to Congress till this day. I've never gotten a ticket. And we knew it was almost impossible. Mrs. Rogers knew it was impossible. So when we planned this idea of dropping a banner on this subject, she said, now I'll see if I can't get the ticket. So she wrote to this man and asked him, the congressman, since he told her always to ask for anything she wanted, he said, one thing I would like to do would be to have a ticket for myself and some of my friends to go in for this opening speech for the president on, you see, for Philippines, whatever it was. So she got the tickets, and she came down to Washington with the tickets. And so she gave one ticket to Miss Vernon, apparently. I didn't remember whom she did give them to. But she kept one ticket for herself. And a little group of four or five, I think, went in with their banners concealed somewhere about their person.
Yeah.
And then when this moment came, I think they all put out their banners.
It was one long banner. One big banner.
Yes, I guess it was one big banner.
Laid down at their feet once they got in.
Yes, I think they all put down the same banner.
Yeah, and they all had a string then that they held it by.
So, anyway, Mrs. Rogers, it's not that I don't think Mabel did everything, because she undoubtedly did, but I just remember the Mrs. Rogers end because that was the end of,
yeah,
that I was familiar with,
sure,
of getting them in. And so they did. And then they were all asked to leave, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very effective. Very effective. It was written up in the papers. And I thought it was a very effective thing to do. But it was all due to this curing. It couldn't have been if we couldn't have gotten the banners. And couldn't have gotten in, and I don't know if we could have gotten in if it hadn't been for this man's feeling of obligation to Dr. Rogers.
Yeah. Well, and that was just a little while before your picketing began. Now, in the meantime, you had the Inez Mulholland Memorial Service.
Yes.
And you brought...
And you know all about that, I'm sure.
You brought Sarah out from the West Coast to... give a speech there, I think.
We brought Sarah for the presentation of the statues at the end.
Yeah.
Well, I showed you the statues, you remember this
yes,
morning?
Yes, I remember she came out for that too. Okay, maybe she didn't come out for the Inez Memorial.
No, she didn't.
Okay.
Because the principal speech was made by Maud Younger.
Hmm.
And I remember this Mr. Gallagher said, well, I remember you told somebody that the way to speak was to read the Lincoln's Gettysburg address and then make the same kind of a speech. And I remember, well, I remembered it too. That was when Maud Younger said, I don't know how I can speak in this tribute to Inez Mulholland or what to say. And so I remember she was the person who made the speech there.
Mm-hmm. We haven't mentioned Inez Mulholland and her work on that 1916 campaign or any of her other work.
Yes, do you want me to? I think I told you about the other night.
Yes, you did, and of course there's quite a lot about her as a result of her death. There's quite a lot written about her, so you don't have to say very much now.
I'll tell you if you want me to. She had graduated, you know, from Vassar, and she'd become well-known because she was the person who organized this meeting in the graveyard at Vassar when the president called her before him and told her that the Board of Trustees were unwilling to have the college have this suffrage meeting. And so then she got the same group she had gathered for the meeting and who had arranged to have three speakers come and took them out to the wall outside the college, which separated the college from the graveyard.
Yeah.
And they all hopped over this wall, you may remember. And I don't know how she got her speakers in, but she got her speakers there too somehow or other. So they held this meeting, and it was such good publicity that people sort of remembered Inez Mulholland as a result. And so she then, I suppose she was about 28 or something like that, and she was already married, and she'd already studied law. She tried to study law at Yale and various good places, but they wouldn't take her because she was a woman. So she went to New York University, which then didn't have much of a reputation, and got a law degree there. Well, then she offered to come into our campaign, and she rode at the head of some of our processions, and one at least. And we have this photograph on many of our letterheads, you know, of her in that procession.
Mm-hmm. On the horse?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So she said that she offered to go over the country and try to arouse women to vote against the Democrats. And her father, John Mulholland, didn't want her to go alone, so he said, well, I will pay all the expenses of my other daughter, Rita, and have her accompany Inez. And Rita had a very beautiful voice, so it was arranged that she would sing suffrage songs and things related to it at every meeting, and then Inez would appeal to the people not to vote for the Democrats. And I remember she said to me that, she said, I want to make one condition, that at every meeting I'm the only speaker. And she said, the reason is that I am very timid and have no self-confidence. And I think maybe I could appeal to women and get them to change their votes. But if there's another speaker there, I know myself and I won't be able to open my mouth. I'll think she's a so much better speaker, so I'll say to her, well, you go ahead and speak. So she said, I know that I can't do it unless I'm left alone, then I'll have to do it. So she started out, and I think was very effective. The meetings she'd seen to me were very effective as well. We could hear she was extra beautiful girl, and extra sort of, she just was, so she was so beaming with her belief in what she was doing, so extremely sincere, and she was doing it against sort of quite a great deal of personal diffidence, she said. So as the meetings went on, one by one, they seemed to me to be bringing in very good results. And then when she got to this meeting in Los Angeles and was speaking, she just fell to the floor and collapsed, and she never regained consciousness. I suppose you know all that.
I didn't know that she'd never regained consciousness.
No, nobody ever had her, spoke to her, ever heard anything from her since.
Was it a stroke?
Well, I don't know whether you can have a stroke when you're 28 or something, can you?
I don't know.
What they said was, what the doctors out there said, that she had pernicious anemia.
Oh.
And that she had not known she had it. And she'd worked so extremely hard and just worn herself out. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a stroke, it might have been a heart attack, but
yeah.
They said it was caused by pernicious anemia, whatever
yeah,
it was.
I see.
So, and they set her body back in the coffin to New York, or to Washington, I guess it was. And no, I guess it was New York, because she was buried up at a family home near Westport, New York. And then we got up this, immediately, in a very short time, in about a week, we got up this memorial meeting in the Capitol and sent a message from the memorial meeting to President Wilson, urging that no more sacrifices like this be made necessary in the effort to get the enfranchisement of women. And Mrs. William Kent offered the resolution, which was good because she was a congressman's wife. We had it up in the statuary hall, and then she took it down with a delegation to the president.
Oh, I see.
She was one of the very wonderful women we had. Very tragic to lose her so young and so soon.
Yeah.
On her first speaking trip. Well, now, what's the next one you have to ask?
Well, it seems to me that right there, when Wilson's response was another one of, I can't, as the leader of my party, do anything that my party doesn't want me to do or take any stand that my party doesn't want me to take. The accounts I read emphasize the extreme disappointment of the women after this meeting as they filed back across the street to suffrage headquarters. They were gloomy and rather silent. And do you remember...
The only thing I remember was that he said that he couldn't... Somewhere along there, I don't know which day, but somewhere along this time, he said that he received so many delegations, and they said the same thing, and he said the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he now had the great world responsibilities because of the threat of war, and he couldn't see any more delegations. That's my recollection.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he said.
And so we then said, all right, we'll send this perpetual delegation,
yeah.
And you won't have to see it. We'll just hold up banners reminding you.
Well, I thought maybe the meeting was scheduled to be held right after their deputation to Wilson. Then they came back across the street for a meeting that had been set and arranged at the suffrage headquarters, And at that time, was this a new decision then to start the picketing, or was it the direct result of Wilson's speech?
No, I think it was the general situation of not being able to go to any more delegations to him that he announced.
Yeah.
And I don't know when he announced it, but somewhere around that period, I always suppose it was because he was getting so involved in. It was a very great thought of war, you know, and we might get in it, and it seemed very natural. So we had quite a long discussion, I guess many days and weeks maybe, before we decided to start in picket, because when you start you have to be prepared to carry it through for a long time or it's ineffective.
Yes, and you knew
so
what
we finally decided to do it. And then we started whatever day we did start in January.
Do you remember anything about the pros and cons of picketing that were discussed at the time?
The what?
The pros and cons of picketing that were discussed as you mulled over whether to picket.
No, I don't. I think just if you and I should decide whether we'd go out and picket somebody today, we'd be about the same thing. Would it be useful and would it be possible to carry it out? Could we get enough people to do it? Because you can't possibly do anything effectively unless you have a little long stretch. You knew that. I think, I don't know, women volunteered to go right away. You see, it's about, like everything, when you say, when you mull over it, what will you do? I think it's always the same. There are lots of pros and cons on any step you take.
Then in April, war was declared.
Yes, April 7th.
And could you relate to me again the
Round Robin.
The incident of Jeanette Rankin?
Oh, yes, I can.
Okay.
We've known Jeanette Rankin, not intimately, but known her, because the first year we went down in 1913, when we were a committee of the old National American, that committee had sent, the National American had sent a Jeanette Rankin down to be called an organizer, to work with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd gotten to know her, and she worked mainly on the legislative work, going up and seeing congressmen. But we didn't get to know her too well. And then she disappeared, and I don't know exactly what she was doing all that time. So then she suddenly appeared in this victorious campaign in Montana, the time that Hazel Hunkins came down, and she'd worked for, you see, up in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And we got up a meeting in conjunction with the National American to welcome the first woman member to Congress, and held it at one of the hotels in Washington. Mm-hmm. And Jeanette Rankin spoke, and I spoke, and I don't know who spoke for the other group.
Mm-hmm.
So then we didn't see her again, and till this vote on war was to come pretty soon. So Hazel Hunkins, by that time, as I said, had come down and was in our Washington headquarters and was our only real Montana connection with Jeanette Rankin. So she and I went up together that night when she was to vote. And we said the Women's Party welcomes all women who work for equality for women, whatever they think about war. And we have in our picket line women who are strong supporters of the war and people who are strong opponents of the war. And we don't take any stand on this as an organization. But both of us take a stand as individual women, and we wanted to tell you how we feel, just so we could feel we'd said this to you, whether it meant anything to you or not. And so we told her we thought it would be a tragedy for the first woman ever in Congress to vote for war, that the one thing that seemed to us so clear was that the women were the peace-loving half of the world, and that by giving power to women we would diminish the possibility, the only place we'd go, I presume, that night. And she came upstairs to see us and talked to us up in the gallery. And Then she went down, and you know, the first time around that the name was called, she didn't answer. And then the second time, when they went around, all the people didn't answer. You remember, she said, I think these were words, because I remember it very clearly. She said, I want to stand by my country, but I cannot vote for war. And now this man from this University of Georgia is writing her life. I told you, he's been up quite a number of times and stayed at our headquarters, and I don't know, Mr. Chittick won't let people in the library what he will do, because he's come in there and gotten so much material for her life and had so many talks with me about her, telling all these things that he doesn't know, that he always comes and stays with us, pays for his room upstairs so he can work there. And so I was talking about him to Jeanette the last time she was there at our headquarters, and she almost always stays with us when she goes to Washington. And so she said, well, I told her that I told him about this time we went up to see her, and I said, I don't know whether you remember it, but I remember it very well. And she said, oh, I do remember it very well, because it was about the only support I received from women in my vote. And she said the most enormous pressure that you possibly can conceive was brought to bear upon me by the suffrage leaders on the ground that I would put back the suffrage cause if I voted for opposing the war. So she said I've been invited up to the home of Mrs. James Lee Laidlaw. You probably don't know her, but she was a very well-known woman then in the suffrage movement in New York, and a lovely woman, and a wealthy woman, and very, very lovely woman. And she said, I wouldn't have believed Mrs. Laidlaw would have done this thing, but she said, well, Mrs. Laidlaw invited me up. She had people come to see me. She entertained me. There was no kind of pressure that she didn't bring to bear, as did the other suffrage leaders, to get me to vote for the war. And then, you know, I told her that this man who was writing her biography came in and told me that he found this letter from Mrs. Catt, and it's written to a personal friend, and probably Mrs. Catt doesn't know it's in the Congressional Library. And that's the harm of getting these letters put in without people classifying them and going through them. But Mrs. Catt just let herself loose against it at Rankin in this letter, and said, she's put this, it's impossible to say how much I detest and so on this Jeanette Rankin. I'm not saying the words, of course. I don't know the words because I didn't see the letter. How terrible it has been, the action of Miss Rankin in casting that vote against war. It's put the suffrage amendment back, maybe back years and years and years and years of what she's done. So this man who was writing her biography came across it and then told me about what it said. And I knew that's what was happening, that was their attitude. So I was very proud of her. And I think she was superb. So when Congress came along to our measure, of course she was extremely helpful. Spoke for it, helped in every way, because she was on the inside and could do what we couldn't do.
Yeah.
In all her speeches, she tells me, she always says, I'm the only woman in the country who ever voted, or whoever will vote, or whoever can vote for the enfranchisement of American women. Because the day that she voted and it went through, of course, it was no longer to be voted on, they got it.
Mm-hmm.